The following audiobooks contain AI-generated content and may contain errors. This audiobook narration presents Human Oversight, Human in the Loop to Human on the Exception Topic Introduction. The rise of organizational AI is often described with dramatic language, but the real story is more practical than that. The central issue is not whether machines can produce impressive answers. It is how organizations decide where work should happen, who should supervise it, when to pause it, and what to do when something goes wrong. In that sense, this lecture is about control architecture. It asks how companies move from human-in-the-loop workflows, where people review and approve outputs, toward human-on-the-exception systems, where machines handle routine work, and humans step in only when policy, risk, or context requires it. That shift matters now because many organizations are already living through it. In the near term, teams use AI as a productivity layer. Drafting, summarizing, classifying, routing, and recommending. But the next phase is more ambitious and more complicated. Agentic systems do not merely answer a prompt and stop. They pursue goals across many steps, use tools, retain context, and keep moving, unless a rule tells them to stop. Once that happens, oversight can no longer mean simply placing a person at the end of the line. It has to become something deeper, more selective, and more operational. This lecture is designed for adult learners who want a clear, research-backed understanding of that transition without getting lost in buzzwords. It assumes curiosity about technology and business, but it does not require specialized technical training. If the listener has ever wondered why some AI deployments feel useful, while others seem to create more review work, more confusion, or more blame, this lecture is meant to make that pattern intelligible. The focus is not on AI as a novelty, it is on AI as part of an organization's decision system. A key idea will appear early and then keep returning. Oversight is not only a moral stance or a legal disclaimer, it is a workflow design choice. When does work pause? Who gets to approve, correct, or reject it? What counts as an exception? Which cases should move automatically, and which should reach a human only when specific conditions are met? These questions sound procedural, but they are really questions about authority, accountability, and the shape of work itself. They determine whether autonomy becomes useful or simply becomes another source of hidden labor. That is where middle management enters the story in a new way. In many organizations, the middle layer was built to approve, coordinate, and report. Under agentic systems, it has to do something different. It must translate executive intent into operating policy, define escalation thresholds, manage exceptions, and keep the boundary between automation and human judgment from becoming either too rigid or too vague. In other words, the question is not whether middle management disappears. The question is whether it evolves into the layer that makes autonomous systems governable. Across the lecture, the listener will be guided through a tension that sits at the heart of modern organizational AI. On one side is the promise of speed, scale, and reduced routine labor. On the other side are the risks of decision fatigue, authority ambiguity, weak auditability, and transformations that create more work for people rather than less. The challenge is not to choose between humans and machines. It is to design a system in which each does what it can do best, and where the human role is reserved for the decisions that truly require judgment, legitimacy, or recovery. By the end of the lecture, the listener should be able to think about oversight in a much more precise way. Instead of asking only whether humans are in the loop, they will be able to ask what kind of loop it is, where the real decision rights live, and how an organization can move toward a model that is faster, safer, and more truthful about responsibility. That is the journey ahead, from familiar approval chains to exception-based governance, and from vague responsibility to a real operating architecture for autonomous work. End of introduction. To understand the current shift in organizational artificial intelligence, it helps to begin with a plain claim. Human oversight is an organizational control architecture. It is not only an ethical preference and not only a legal safeguard. It is the operating design that determines where work is rooted, when execution pauses, who is allowed to act, how failures are recovered from, and how accountability becomes concrete rather than rhetorical. Oversight answers practical questions. Does work stop automatically or continue by default? Who sees uncertain cases? Who can approve, correct, or reverse an action? When something goes wrong, does the system retry, escalate, roll back, or simply wait? When an organization says humans remain responsible, the real issue is whether the workflow gives people a defined moment to intervene, enough context to judge, and real authority to change outcomes. If those conditions are absent, responsibility exists mostly in language rather than in operations. That is why the phrase human in the loop needs precision. It does not just mean people are involved. It describes a workflow in which execution pauses so a person can review, label, approve, correct, or escalate before work continues. In many business systems, this shows up as recognizable patterns. A model produces a draft, and a human must approve it before the system can send it. A system classifies a case, but a person reviews uncertain items. Teams do annotation and labeling work that corrects categories or supplies judgments that keep a process on track. Many workflows also include approval checkpoints, where permission is required before the next step becomes real. Sometimes the system proceeds only after a person clarifies intent, grants access, or interprets what the goal means in context. In all these cases, the defining feature is the pause. Work does not continue until a human action reopens the path forward. Seen from the inside, human in the loop often behaves less like continuous collaboration and more like synchronized review. The machine may generate quickly, but the business process advances at the speed of review capacity. This matters because many organizations speak about human in the loop as though it were a broad moral principle. In practice, it is usually a specific routing rule. A human sits at a gate, and the gate opens only when the human reviews, approves, or redirects the work. There are real advantages to this model. It preserves visible human judgment. It can block obvious errors before they become actions in the world. It gives organizations a familiar approval structure, and familiarity matters when enterprises already know how to operate sign-off chains, exception queues, and managerial approvals. A pause also provides a simple answer to a question leaders, auditors, customers, and internal stakeholders often ask: who checked this before it moved forward? That visible checkpoint can support trust, especially in early deployments, when organizations are not yet willing to let AI outputs move directly into execution. At the same time, a pause creates limits. Every pause adds time. Every checkpoint consumes attention. Every required approval turns human judgment into a scarce production input. As volume increases, review queues increase as well. What looks efficient at the moment of generation can still be constrained by human throughput. This constraint changes the quality of review. When people must approve large numbers of routine outputs, their attention thins out. Decision fatigue appears. The reviewer sees more cases than can be meaningfully considered, and the process can quietly shift from judgment to clearance. The checkpoint stays visible, but its substance weakens. This is where rubber stamp approval becomes a serious organizational problem. Under time pressure, reviewers may approve because deep checking or careful rejection is unrealistic. The process then preserves the appearance of control while eroding the quality of control. The checkpoint looks like the moment of authority, but it may not be the moment where authority was truly designed. That leads to a deeper question. Who actually owns the decision? Is it the person who clicked approve? The manager who designed the checkpoint? The executive who accepted the risk of using the system? The team that set the threshold that determines when a case reaches human review? Human in the loop can make ownership look settled because the final human action is easy to point to. Still, the last visible touch is not always the true source of decision authority. Human in the loop also narrows what organizations imagine failure to be. In a simple framing, failure looks like a bad output caught at the gate. That is one kind of failure. Work can also fail because the wrong cases are routed to humans, because review arrives too late, or because the reviewer lacks context, lacks authority, or sees only the output and not the path that produced it. It can also fail because the system escalates too much low-value work, so high-value exceptions receive less attention than they need. Control architecture is not only about catching errors, it is about deciding where human effort is placed, what it is meant to do, and how the organization behaves when normal flow breaks down. These issues become more acute as the unit of work changes. Human in the loop fits most naturally when the basic pattern is one prompt and one answer, or one recommendation and one approval. It becomes harder to sustain when the system behaves less like a single-step assistant and more like an autonomous agent ecosystem. In the 2026 era, the reference point shifts. The system is not only a tool that waits for a fresh prompt each time, it is a set of agents that pursue goals over many steps. These systems can break complex tasks into smaller subtasks. They can plan sequences rather than produce isolated responses. They can use external tools, interact with software systems, retrieve information, and handwork to specialized components. They can retain context across time, and they can resume activity after waiting for new input or permission. The key change is simple but far-reaching. The system is no longer defined mainly by what it says next. It is defined by what it does next. An agent, in this sense, is software that can carry a task forward across multiple actions. Instead of ending with a single response, it can continue through retrieval, checking, revising, routing, tool use, and follow-up. Because context persists, decisions made early in the chain can shape what happens later. Because execution can continue across time, oversight cannot rely only on the old idea of a person approving each visible step. In a human-in-the-loop workflow, the defining question is where execution pauses for a person. In an agent ecosystem, a more important question becomes what the system is allowed to do until a policy boundary is reached. Oversight can still include human review of outputs. It can still include human approval of high-stakes actions. However, the core architecture changes. Humans are no longer primarily asked to stand in front of every next step. They are asked to define boundaries within which many next steps may occur automatically. That changes the practical questions. What tools may the agent use? What information may it access? What kinds of actions require explicit permission? Which thresholds trigger escalation? When must the system stop and ask for clarification? What forms of recovery are allowed if something goes wrong? These are governance questions, not merely approval questions. A useful way to hold the comparison in mind is to listen for structural dimensions. First is where work happens. In a human-in-the-loop workflow, much of the meaningful control happens at the review gate. The machine prepares an output, but the human effectively decides whether that output enters the real world. In an agent ecosystem, more of the work happens inside a chain of delegated activity: planning, retrieval, verification attempts, tool use, and internal handoffs can occur before any human sees a finished result. The center of gravity shifts from the approval moment to the operating process itself. Control becomes less about inspecting a final artifact and more about shaping the conditions under which an artifact, action, or recommendation is produced. Second is what humans supervise. In human-in-the-loop systems, people mainly supervise outputs. They inspect the draft, confirm the label, approve the recommendation, or decide whether the next step is acceptable. In agent ecosystems, people increasingly supervise objectives, permissions, thresholds, and exceptions. They ask whether the task was framed correctly, whether the system stayed inside policy, whether unusual cases were escalated, and whether behavior across time remained acceptable. This shifts human supervision from repetitive review of individual artifacts toward defining what counts as routine in the first place. It also means supervision often targets patterns rather than isolated outputs. The relevant question becomes not only, is this one output acceptable, but also, is the system behaving acceptably across many steps, many cases, and changing conditions? Third is failure. Human-in-the-loop systems often anticipate local, visible failures. A recommendation may be wrong, a message may be misleading, a classification may need correction, or a low-confidence case may require human intervention. Agent ecosystems force attention toward systemic failures. A task can be decomposed badly. A tool can be used in the wrong order. Context can persist when it should not, or disappear when continuity is required. A system can pursue one objective too aggressively and neglect a competing business constraint. Even if each step seems individually plausible, the overall sequence can still produce a bad outcome. Failure becomes an operational pattern that unfolds across time. Once failure has that shape, recovery must be designed into the architecture. Stopping, retrying, quarantining a case, rolling back an action, or escalating to a specific human owner are part of what oversight means. Fourth is accountability. In many human-in-the-loop systems, accountability is operationalized by asking who approved the item. That question remains useful, but it is not enough once agents act across many steps. Accountability must also answer who defined the goal, who set the policy boundary, who assigned tool permissions, who tuned escalation logic, who monitored exceptions, and who had the authority to intervene when conditions changed. A final human signature does not explain a multi-step process by itself. Operational accountability requires decision rights that are clear before the system acts, not only blame assignment after a failure becomes visible. Taken together, these dimensions show why the old slogan of keeping humans in the loop is too narrow for the emerging environment. It treats oversight mainly as a stop signal. The newer environment treats oversight as a governed operating space. The question is not whether humans vanish. The question is where human authority sits, how it is expressed in policy, and how it becomes actionable inside a process that can continue between moments of direct human attention. This is where the idea of human-agent equilibrium becomes useful. Equilibrium does not mean equality between humans and machines, and it does not mean comfort. It means a workable balance. Autonomy is bounded. Supervision is exception-based. Accountability is built into operations rather than asserted after the fact. Bounded autonomy means agents may act, but only inside explicit limits. Exception-based supervision means people do not spend their time rechecking every routine action. They focus on cases that cross thresholds, create conflict, require interpretation, or carry unusual consequence. Built-in accountability means the workflow makes clear who set the rules, who owned the case, who received the exception, and what happened next. This is not an argument for maximum automation. Sending every minor case to a human is not automatically safer. It may simply consume attention that should be reserved for harder problems. Removing humans without clear policy boundaries is not efficient. It is uncontrolled. Equilibrium lies between those failures. Keeping autonomy inside defined limits and reserving human judgment for moments when judgment actually matters. Reaching that equilibrium depends on a layer that is often discussed too loosely. Middle management here is not just a job title, and not only the people between a senior leadership team and frontline workers. It is a mediator layer. It translates business intent into operational policy. It turns general priorities into permissions, thresholds, service levels, quality expectations, escalation routes, and recovery logic. It also coordinates cross-functional judgment when different parts of the organization see the same case differently. In that architecture, distinct roles become easier to see. Executives and governance owners set risk appetite. In this setting, risk appetite means the amount and type of risk the organization is prepared to tolerate as work proceeds. The middle layer converts that appetite into operating policy. It decides how strict thresholds should be, how escalation paths work, what counts as a meaningful exception, and which cases deserve scarce human review capacity. Human creative teams contribute domain judgment, stakeholder interpretation, and context-sensitive reasoning. They recognize when a technically acceptable action is still commercially unwise, socially tone-deaf, strategically mistimed, or out of alignment with real human expectations. Creative does not refer only to artistic work. It refers to any work where meaning, interpretation, and contextual fit matter more than simple repetition. As agents become more capable, this mediator layer can become more important, not less. A common assumption is that stronger agents flatten the organization by reducing the need for translation and coordination. The opposite is often closer to the truth. The more an agent can do, the more consequential its boundaries become. The more steps it can take, the more important it is to decide which steps belong together, which permissions travel with the task, what counts as a normal case, and when local optimization should give way to wider organizational concerns. Agents can execute tasks, but organizations still need to resolve trade-offs between speed and accuracy, efficiency and trust, local objectives, and enterprise-wide constraints. Agents can follow rules, but they do not decide which rule should prevail when rules conflict. Agents can generate options, but they do not confer legitimacy on the policy that governs those options. People still need to define boundaries, interpret trade-offs, and reconcile conflicts across functions. That is what the middle layer does at its best. It translates downward and upward at the same time, turning strategic intent into operational policy and turning anomalies, edge cases, and repeated exceptions into revised thresholds, updated rules, or requests for executive judgment. Without that layer, executive goals remain too abstract, and frontline feedback remains too fragmented. Agents then either operate too freely or escalate too often. Both failures are costly. They are also signals that decision rights were not redesigned to match the new system. The stakes are not only technical, they are psychological and organizational too. Decision fatigue is one immediate example. When people are asked to approve large amounts of routine work, their attention degrades. Review becomes quicker, thinner, and more automatic. The checkpoint remains visible, but the quality of judgment declines. Authority ambiguity is subtler, but it matters just as much. If an agent acts within preset rules and the result is poor or harmful, who had real authority over that outcome? The reviewer may never have seen the case. The manager may have set the threshold without controlling the underlying objective. The executive may have approved the program in general terms without specifying the exact boundary conditions. When roles blur in this way, organizations swing between two bad patterns. In one pattern, everything escalates because nobody wants to own risk. In the other, too much proceeds automatically because everyone assumes someone else owns the boundary. Either way, blame dynamics tend to follow. After a failure, institutions often look for the last visible human touch. That search is understandable, but it can be misleading. The last reviewer may be blamed for a problem created upstream by vague policy, unrealistic review load, poor escalation design, or missing recovery logic. Once employees learn that blame attaches to visibility, they adapt defensively. Some approve mechanically to keep work moving. Others escalate preemptively to avoid exposure. Neither behavior creates real control. Both are symptoms of an architecture that asks humans to absorb responsibility without aligning authority, information, and time. This is also where governance can become a bottleneck instead of a control system. A bottleneck receives work because the organization has not redesigned decision rights. A control system receives only the cases that truly require human judgment. In a bottleneck, humans redo routine work already performed. In a control system, humans focus on novelty, ambiguity, stakeholder-sensitive decisions, conflicting objectives, and failures that require informed recovery. So the goal is not more escalation. The goal is better escalation. A well-designed exception path protects human attention for cases that justify it. That contrast supports a practical verbal distinction. Human in the loop asks what a human must approve before work continues. Human on the exception asks what may proceed automatically and what conditions require human intervention. The first question organizes work around mandatory gates. The second organizes work around permissions, thresholds, and recovery paths. The first fits environments where systems mostly produce discrete outputs. The second becomes necessary when systems act across many steps and across time. Human on the exception does not remove humans from responsibility. It places responsibility where it can actually be exercised meaningfully. Instead of forcing human judgment into every pause, it reserves judgment for the situations that define an organization's real values, risks, and trade-offs. In this part, the foundation is in view. Human oversight is a control architecture. Human in the loop is one specific version, centered on pauses, review, and approval. It offers visible judgment and a familiar enterprise structure, but it can so work, overload reviewers, encourage rubber stamp behavior, and obscure who truly owns decisions. Autonomous agent ecosystems change the unit of work from a single output to a continuing process. That shift moves oversight away from checkpoint approval and toward governed autonomy, exception design, recovery logic, and operational accountability. In the next step, the focus turns to why many legacy middle management layers struggle when asked to govern autonomous agents. Systems built to approve, coordinate, and report can struggle when the real need becomes policy ownership, exception governance, and continuous boundary tuning. Once work unfolds as a chain of actions rather than a single output, oversight has to shift again. The organization is no longer mainly reviewing artifacts one by one. It is governing behavior across steps, across time, and across tool use. That mechanism change matters most in agent systems. The central question is no longer only whether a final draft looks acceptable. It is what the system is allowed to keep doing before a human becomes necessary. In that setting, escalation logic becomes a primary control knob. It decides whether an agent proceeds, pauses, sends a case for review, or is blocked from acting at all. It also determines where scarce human attention goes. This makes escalation more than a technical setting. It is a decision rights design. It defines the default direction of motion in the workflow. If the logic is permissive, the system moves unless something unusual interrupts it. If the logic is strict, the system pauses often, and humans absorb more of the operating load. A common early instinct is to build escalation around confidence alone. The idea sounds clean. If confidence is low, escalate. If confidence is high, proceed. However, confidence-only escalation tends to break down quickly. When thresholds are set too low, humans are flooded with reviews, many of them routine and low value. Review queues grow. Decision fatigue returns. The organization recreates the old bottleneck under a new name. When thresholds are set too high, the opposite problem appears. Some actions remain highly confident and still wrong, unsafe, or outside policy. Confidence can reflect how strongly a system favors an output. It does not, by itself, prove that the action is authorized or that the context is reliable enough to act on. Once confidence becomes the only trigger, organizations fall into what can be understood as an escalation trap. In one form, escalation saturates the human layer. Managers and reviewers become a throughput bottleneck, and attention shifts from judgment to clearance. In the other form, boundary decisions fail silently. The agent continues through cases that should have raised a hand, and it becomes difficult to explain who owned the authority behind those actions. Poor escalation design also creates recurring failure patterns that are easy to underestimate. One pattern is selection bias. If humans see only the cases the system already labels as uncertain, the organization learns from a distorted sample of reality. High confidence mistakes remain largely invisible. That can produce a false sense of security, because visible exceptions are being handled while serious but unflagged errors continue elsewhere. Selection bias also distorts learning, because corrections arrive only from escalated cases, so the system is trained and evaluated on a narrow band of difficulty rather than the full range of decisions. Another pattern is avoidance pressure. People adapt to the incentives created by the workflow. If teams are judged mainly on speed, they may quietly raise thresholds so fewer cases escalate. If they are judged mainly on avoiding blame, they may lower thresholds or escalate too broadly so responsibility moves upward. In both directions, the control architecture becomes a coping mechanism for human incentives rather than a principled boundary for autonomous action. The organization is no longer governing behavior. It is reacting to pressure. A third pattern appears when policies or stakeholder demands conflict, and the system has no legitimate way to resolve the collision. The agent is then pushed toward improvising authority it was never given. This is a governance failure, not merely a prediction error. A safer design treats boundary setting as multi-trigger governance rather than as a single threshold. An agent should escalate for different reasons, and those reasons should reflect organizational legitimacy, not only model uncertainty. Three triggers are especially important. Escalation when the rules are silent, escalation when the state is unconfirmed, and escalation when there is irreconcilable conflict. Together, these triggers change the character of oversight. They move escalation away from a narrow question of confidence and toward whether the system has the right conditions to act at all. Start with the rules silent trigger. A rules silent case is one in which the organization has not provided an explicit policy, permission, or resolution path for the decision at hand. In many legacy workflows, that kind of gap is quietly absorbed into human discretion. A person notices that the manual does not quite cover the case and makes a local judgment. Agent systems cannot be allowed to absorb those gaps invisibly. If the rules are silent, the system should escalate rather than silently expanding its own discretion. This matters because silent rule gaps are one of the main ways autonomy grows without anyone formally choosing it. A system encounters novelty, handles it as best it can, and that behavior gradually becomes normalized. Over time, the organization begins to treat improvised agent behavior as if it were sanctioned policy. The rules silent trigger prevents that drift by insisting that novelty is not the same as permission. If no explicit rule covers the case, human authority must re-enter the process. The second trigger is state unconfirmed. The problem here is not that policy is missing. The problem is that relevant context cannot be trusted enough to proceed. Critical information may be missing, stale, contradictory, or impossible to verify. A prior instruction may conflict with current context. A stored memory may not match current records. An external tool may return uncertain or outdated state. Under throughput pressure, organizations are often tempted to let the system continue on a best guess. That is exactly when risk accumulates. Good governance treats unstable state as a reason to halt or pause, not as a reason to hope for the best. This trigger becomes clearer in agent workflows because many actions depend on accumulated context. A small error in state can propagate across multiple steps. An incorrect assumption can shape retrieval, tool selection, follow-up actions, and final outcomes. The state unconfirmed trigger protects against that cascading effect. It says that when the operating picture is unreliable, the system does not earn the right to continue merely because continuation is faster. The third trigger is irreconcilable conflict. This applies when multiple valid obligations collide and no defined resolution mechanism exists. One policy may favor speed, while another requires extra review. One obligation may call for completion, while another calls for restraint. One stakeholder may prioritize operational efficiency, while another prioritizes a stricter interpretation of risk. Human organizations live with these collisions all the time. The important point is that an agent should not be forced to invent its own authority when such a conflict appears. If no rule specifies which obligation prevails, escalation is the correct behavior. Otherwise, the system is not merely executing policy. It is choosing among competing claims of authority, and that kind of judgment usually belongs to responsible humans or formal governance bodies. These three triggers together support a stronger idea of boundary design. They do not ask only whether the system is uncertain. They ask whether the decision is covered, whether the state is trustworthy, and whether the governing obligations are compatible. This is also why older middle layers often struggle. Many were built around approvals, reporting, and coordination. They were not built to define rule coverage, inspect state reliability, or adjudicate unresolved policy conflict. Agent ecosystems expose that limitation quickly. Once escalation is designed as multi-trigger boundary governance, the next question is how much authority the organization should delegate inside those boundaries. This should not be treated as a binary choice between manual work and full automation. A better frame is maturity. One useful way to describe that maturity is a decision delegation index. The phrase describes a structured description of how much decision authority an agent has earned through evidence. At the lowest end, humans still do the work, and the system assists with drafts, summaries, or suggestions. A step higher, the system can prepare or recommend an action, yet a human must approve before execution continues. That is the familiar human-in-the-loop stage. Higher still, the organization shifts toward human on the exception oversight. In that model, the system acts within bounded domains, and humans audit by exception rather than by default approval. Beyond that point, broader autonomous execution becomes possible only when transparency, audit trails, and intervention rights are strong enough that accountability remains real even as routine human review declines. The value of this maturity view is that it replaces the fantasy of a sudden switch with a governance progression. Delegation is earned, not announced. Organizations need reliability gates before they expand autonomy. Performance evidence matters. Policy violation rates matter. Recoverability matters. Recoverability means the ability to halt, contain, reverse, or repair the effects of a bad action before the damage spreads. Executive enthusiasm is not a reliability gate. A compelling demonstration is not a reliability gate either. The question is whether the system has shown, under realistic conditions, that it stays within policy, that violations are rare and visible, and that failures can be corrected without chaos. If those conditions are weak, autonomy should not expand merely because the technology appears capable. This is where the middle management layer becomes more important than many early automation narratives suggest. Its task is no longer only to approve work and relay status updates upward. It has to translate business goals into operational policy and tune escalation thresholds continuously. It also has to enforce boundary conditions that determine what agents may do without interruption. That is a fundamentally different job. It requires deciding which cases belong in automatic flow, which belong in exception queues, who receives which escalations, how quickly review should occur, and what forms of recovery are acceptable. It also requires continuous adjustment. Thresholds that made sense at one stage may be wrong later. A review queue that was manageable at low volume may become dysfunctional at scale. A policy boundary that looked safe in a pilot may prove too vague in daily use. The middle layer has to own that tuning process because it sits closest to operational trade-offs. It sees where business goals, workload realities, and policy constraints collide. It is the part of the organization best positioned to translate those collisions into workable rules. As auditability grows, the manager's role changes again. The old form of authority often centered on sign-off. A manager approved a case, and that approval served as the visible mark of control. In agent systems, that model becomes less central. What matters more is explainability and governance ownership. The manager has to explain why the system was allowed to act, what rule it relied on, what state it considered, where it paused, what it escalated, and how the organization can reconstruct the path afterward. In that sense, the manager becomes less of a case-by-case approver and more of a policy owner, exception designer, and accountability anchor. That shift is difficult because it asks organizations to value a different kind of managerial competence. The new competence depends heavily on decision traces. A decision trace is the recorded chain that links an initial data event to the context the system looked up, the model output it produced, the action the agent executed, and the downstream outcome that followed. The point of the trace is not only record keeping, it is lineage. It allows the organization to reconstruct how a decision happened across multiple steps and systems. A useful trace includes originating data events so the organization knows what started the process. It includes timestamps so the sequence of events is clear. It captures context lookups so investigators can see what information the agent retrieved or relied upon. It preserves model outputs so later review can distinguish between what the model suggested and what the agent actually did. It logs executed actions so there is a record of what changed in the world. It includes downstream outcomes so the organization can connect the action to its effects. It also needs correlation links so those pieces tie together across tools, services, and time. Without that chain, oversight becomes shallow very quickly. A team may know something went wrong, yet still fail to see whether the failure began with bad input, missing context, a flawed model output, an unauthorized action, or a weak recovery routine. Decision traces therefore do more than support audits after the fact. They let managers govern systems during normal operation. They reveal recurring escalation patterns. They show where rules are too vague. They expose whether a queue is filling with the same kind of exception repeatedly. They help separate model error from policy error and policy error from process error. That distinction matters because different failures demand different fixes. A prediction problem may call for better evaluation or calibration. A policy problem may call for a new boundary. A process problem may call for a different handoff, permission rule, or rollback path. Public governance frameworks push organizations in this direction by turning broad principles into practical expectations. The National Institute of Standards and Technology Artificial Intelligence Risk Management Framework emphasizes governing, mapping, measuring, and managing risk. Governing means roles and accountability have to exist. Mapping means the organization has to understand where the system is used, what it affects, and what dependencies matter. Measuring means risk cannot remain purely anecdotal. It has to be observed and evaluated. Managing means responses, controls, and corrections must actually change how the system runs. The European Union Artificial Intelligence Act pushes on a related set of issues from a regulatory angle. It places stricter obligations on higher risk uses and expects effective human oversight, where stakes justify it. Taken together, frameworks like these do not merely ask organizations to speak about responsibility. They expect responsibility to be instantiated in the workflow. That expectation translates into everyday design choices. Agents need distinct identities so actions can be tied to specific operational roles rather than hidden behind a generic shared account. Permissions need to be scoped so the system can do only what its role requires, not whatever a broad tool account happens to allow. Access revocation needs to be real and timely, so autonomy can be reduced or stopped when conditions change. Audit trails need to exist and stay connected across steps. Override mechanisms need to let humans interrupt, stop, or reverse actions when policy or context demands it. And the organization needs evidence that human intervention is genuinely possible when required, not merely asserted in a policy manual. These design choices reveal an important accountability pitfall in agent systems, accountability without authority. A manager cannot be meaningfully accountable for an agent's outcomes if that manager lacks control, access, escalation rights, veto power, or governance visibility. If the person named as accountable cannot inspect traces, cannot change thresholds, cannot revoke permissions, cannot redirect escalations, and cannot see what the system is doing, accountability becomes mostly rhetorical. The organization has assigned exposure without assigning control. That is not a sound governance design. It is a blame allocation strategy. A similar issue appears in responsibility charts, such as responsible, accountable, consulted, and informed. Those structures work only when they map to real operating rights. A name in the accountable position is not enough. The person has to possess the corresponding authority inside the workflow, including escalation access, permission to intervene, visibility into system behavior, and power to stop or redirect execution. Otherwise, the chart misleads everyone. This is one reason authority ambiguity becomes so corrosive in agent environments. Many organizations still interpret responsibility through older norms of ownership. They ask who owns the process, who approved the case, or who is on the hook if something goes wrong. Agent systems, however, communicate in a different language. They surface uncertainty signals, constraints, confidence information, policy flags, and state checks. Those are useful operational signals, but they do not automatically answer the human question of ownership. A manager may hear that a system flagged low confidence or conflicting state and still ask who decided to let it continue. A team may hear that an action stayed within permissions and still ask who had the legitimacy to define those permissions. When those two languages are not connected, confusion spreads even when the technical controls appear sophisticated. Decision fatigue then compounds the problem. Excessive review loads wear down attention, and humans faced with long queues begin to clear rather than judge. That can encourage rubber stamp approval in one direction and over-escalation in the other. At the same time, unclear attribution encourages blame dynamics after failures. The last visible human touch becomes the easiest point to identify, even if it was not the decision authority. Both responses are understandable. Neither creates a healthy control system. A better design turns feedback into a control loop rather than leaving it as scattered reaction. Human corrections should improve evaluation criteria. They should calibrate confidence and thresholds. They should update policy boundaries and reduce unnecessary escalations over time. If reviewers repeatedly correct the same class of cases, that is information about the system. It is also information about boundary design. Perhaps the rule is too vague. Perhaps the trigger is too narrow. Perhaps the state check is weak. Perhaps the review team lacks context needed to make the exception meaningful. In the opposite direction, if humans keep approving escalations with no substantial modification, that suggests the system pauses too often and wastes scarce attention. Feedback, in other words, is not only about improving model performance. It is about improving the architecture that decides when humans should be involved at all. The middle management layer is again the operational translator. It has to take corrections from human reviewers and convert them into revised criteria, better thresholds, clearer boundaries, and more effective exception routing. Without that translation step, feedback remains local and temporary. With it, feedback becomes a governance asset. However, improvement through feedback is not automatic. Some domains generate strong, repeated patterns that allow boundaries to tighten over time. Other domains involve rare events, shifting conditions, or contested judgments that resist clean optimization. Organizations should avoid promising a smooth path in which every round of human input steadily reduces oversight needs. Sometimes it does. Sometimes it stabilizes only modestly. Sometimes new capabilities create new kinds of exceptions as quickly as old ones are resolved. quiet technical enablers make these governance patterns workable in the background. Agent orchestration layers help coordinate multi-step execution and keep track of state, handoffs, and dependencies. Persistent memory integrity. Rules determine what the system may store, how stored context is validated, when it expires, and how corrections replace or quarantine bad memory. Recovery patterns define what happens after failure. Some cases may require retry. Others may require rollback. Others may need quarantine, incident creation, or handoff to a specific human owner. Failure handling routines decide which recovery path is appropriate and under what conditions. Without this supporting machinery, governance remains aspirational. An organization may say an agent should stop when state is unreliable. If there is no reliable halt, rollback, or recovery routine, the rule has little force in practice. Integration. Standardization can also become a governance tool. A developing standard for connecting models to external tools can make connectivity more consistent across agents and systems. That matters for convenience, but it also matters for control. More consistent connectivity can create centralized enforcement points for validation, permission checks, and logging. Instead of every tool integration becoming a separate hidden path for action, standardization can make it easier to apply the same guardrails across the environment. Standardization does not solve governance by itself, but it can reduce fragmentation and make oversight more coherent, especially in large enterprises where agents interact with many tools and services. Even with these design principles in place, several questions remain open. The ideal ratio of human oversight to agent autonomy does not have a universal answer. It depends on the risk of the domain, the maturity of the organization, the quality of traces, the recoverability of failures, and the seriousness of downstream consequences. Feedback loops also improve at different rates. Some organizations learn quickly from corrections and sharpen boundaries. Others face noisy inputs, weak governance ownership, or too few repeated cases to tune with confidence. Psychological safety is another uncertain variable. Early adoption can go more smoothly when people feel safe reporting problems and escalating concerns, but sustained use still depends on incentives, workload realities, and ongoing alignment between accountability and authority. The larger lesson is that agentic oversight is not solved by declaring that humans remain responsible. Responsibility has to be converted into permissions, traces, escalation routes, override powers, and operating boundaries that make intervention real. It also has to be carried by a middle layer that is willing and able to own policy, not merely pass approvals up or down the organization. That is the structural redesign now underway in many organizations. The middle management layer must become a policy and exception governance layer. If it does not, autonomy tends to collapse into one of two outcomes. Either it becomes a bottleneck, because humans are buried in review that should never have reached them, or it becomes an accountability gap, because agents act across time and no one can fully explain who had legitimate authority to let those actions proceed. The path beyond that dilemma is not more rhetoric about keeping a human nearby. It is a more disciplined design of escalation, delegation, traceability, and intervention. That is what makes autonomy governable rather than merely impressive, and it is the foundation for the practical redesign that follows. At this point, the contrast can be stated in the most practical form. Human in the loop is a decision architecture built around discrete approval. Work pauses, a person reviews, and the next step depends on that human signal. Human on the exception is a different architecture. Work proceeds within defined policy boundaries, and human attention is reserved for cases that cross those boundaries. The first model organizes control around frequent pauses. The second organizes control around explicit limits, exceptions, and intervention rights. That shift is not only procedural, it changes who actually owns decisions. Many organizations try to make the transition by adding better tools, more workflow checklists, or another layer of sign-off. Those moves can tidy process maps, but they usually do not change the underlying control architecture. Without a redesign of decision rights, old approval habits get wrapped around new agent systems. The result tends to be either a bottleneck, where humans still approve routine flow, or an accountability gap, where agents act across time and it becomes unclear who had legitimate authority over the outcomes. Decision rights redesign is easiest to understand in roles and permissions terms. For each class of decisions, the organization specifies who owns the decision, what an agent is allowed to do, which permissions attach to that role, how narrowly those permissions are scoped, and how quickly they can be revoked. It also defines which actions remain human-only, which are executable by agents under routine conditions, and which are neither owned by humans nor by agents in advance, because they must be routed for review as exceptions. Responsibility becomes real only when those rights exist in the workflow, not only in policy language. That is why organizations have to stop speaking vaguely about keeping humans responsible and start speaking concretely about authority. Who can authorize a customer-facing action? Who can release internal content? Who can use a tool that changes records? Who can approve a high-sensitivity output? Who can halt an agent? Who can revoke access? Who receives the escalation when the system reaches a boundary? These are not minor implementation details. They are the operating definition of oversight. In this setting, an exception is not merely a case that feels unusual. It is a governance artifact, defined in advance and expressed in policy, encoded in workflow rules, or some combination of those. An exception definition specifies the conditions under which normal automatic flow is no longer legitimate. Some work is out of scope from the beginning. Some cases cross a threshold the organization has decided matters. Some arrive with missing or conflicting state. Some request prohibited actions. Some reveal a policy conflict the system cannot resolve under existing rules. When those categories are specified clearly, escalation becomes disciplined rather than improvised. Otherwise, exceptions are after-the-fact surprises. A team notices something odd, sends a message, and hopes the right manager responds. Human on the exception cannot work that way. The exception has to be designed before it occurs. Otherwise, the system is not governed by boundaries. It is governed by improvisation and luck. A durable exception definition tells the agent what to do when normal flow fails. It also tells humans what they are expected to own when that failure appears. For middle managers, triggers still have to translate into plain operational language. Some exceptions are reviewable. Those should pause the work and route the case to the right human owner. Some actions are prohibited. Those should be rejected immediately, not negotiated at the edge of the workflow. Some classes are recoverable and low impact. Those may be logged for audit and trend review without interrupting a person each time, provided the recovery path is already defined and the class truly stays inside safe bounds. The goal is to give the organization simple verbs it can enforce: proceed, pause, escalate, reject, or log. A clear mental picture helps. Routine work proceeds under scope, with a defined goal, valid permissions, confirmed state, and an action that stays inside policy. Borderline work pauses for human review because it approaches a threshold, depends on context the agent cannot validate, or involves a judgment that remains human-owned. Policy conflicted work enters an escalation path when designated human authority can interpret the conflict. Prohibited work stops immediately. And when the conflict is truly irreconcilable under current rules, the system hits a hard limit and waits for human resolution rather than manufacturing authority for itself. The architecture's heart is that the routine path is fast because it is legitimate. The paused path is selective because the exception was defined in advance. The escalation path is accountable because a human owner is named before the case appears. The hard limit is visible because some actions should not proceed under uncertainty or conflict. Once those paths exist, human attention shifts away from repetitive approval and toward moments where judgment, legitimacy, and conflict resolution are genuinely required. A workable transition is usually staged. A dramatic declaration of full autonomy rarely produces reliable control. A better roadmap begins with bounded delegation. It then builds enforcement and trace infrastructure. It tests reliability gates. Only then does it expand autonomy when evidence supports the change. This sequencing respects learning and operational risk, and it respects a basic organizational fact. The transition is not only about software, it is about changing where authority lives. The first stage is to map current decisions. Not every task deserves the same treatment. Not every approval is equally valuable. A useful mapping sorts decision classes by how often they occur, how risky they are, whether bad actions are reversible, how sensitive stakeholders and external legitimacy are, and what the cost of human review becomes in practice. Frequency matters because high-volume routine decisions consume attention differently than rare decisions. Risk matters because some errors are contained, while others carry wide consequences. Reversibility matters because recoverable harm is governed differently from harm that cannot be easily recalled. Stakeholder sensitivity matters because some actions affect trust and meaning in ways accuracy alone does not capture. Human review cost matters because mandatory review can create delay, fatigue, and hidden error. This mapping step is often skipped because it feels less exciting than deploying agents. Yet it is where bounded delegation begins. An organization cannot decide what to automate, what to escalate, or what to keep human-owned without identifying what kinds of decisions it is actually making. The point is not to catalog every small motion. The point is to identify recurring decision classes and understand what makes them different in operational terms. Once those classes are visible, the second stage is to assign decision rights explicitly. Some decisions remain human-owned because they define values, interpret stakeholder meaning, or resolve cross-functional trade-offs. Some become agent-executable because they are routine, well-scoped, and supported by stable policy and recoverable outcomes. Some are defined as exceptions in advance because their legitimacy depends on human judgment under particular conditions. This is the stage where the organization states, clearly and without euphemism, which decisions no longer require routine approval and which still do. That explicit assignment matters because ambiguity is expensive. If a decision is still human-owned, the human owner must be named, informed, and equipped to intervene. If a decision is agent-executable, allowed actions must be specific rather than implied. If a decision class is treated as an exception, the trigger conditions and the receiving authority must be clear before the workflow runs. Human on the exception is not necessarily looser than human in the loop. In many ways, it can be stricter because it forces the organization to declare boundaries instead of hiding them into informal review habits. This second stage is also where scoped and revocable permissions become central. An agent should not receive broad access just because broad access is convenient. It should receive the minimum permissions required for the decision classes it has been allowed to execute. Those permissions should be tied to role, task, tool, and context. They should be revocable without delay. Revocability is one of the clearest signs that authority is real. If permissions cannot be withdrawn when conditions change, the organization is not delegating in a controlled way. It is hoping. The third stage is to build the machinery that makes decision rights enforceable. Policy enforcement needs to exist before autonomy widens, not after a failure. Agents need distinct identities rather than generic shared access. Permissions need to be checked at runtime. Prohibited actions need to be blocked automatically. Logging has to capture what the system attempted, what it was allowed to do, what it actually did, and why it escalated when it did. Decision traces have to be produced consistently enough that the organization can reconstruct a case without detective work. Even when this stage feels technical, it remains governance. Identity controls decide whether accountability can be tied to operational roles. Scoped permissions decide whether an agent can act only within its assignment. Logging decides whether oversight is demonstrable or just asserted. Decision traces decide whether the organization can separate model error from policy error and policy error from process error. Before autonomy expands, these foundations have to be reliably boring, because boring reliability is what keeps governance from becoming a slogan. The fourth stage is cautious expansion through reliability gates and feedback loops. A reliability gate is a condition the system must satisfy before delegation widens. It asks whether the current boundary is holding under real workload. It asks whether policy violation rates remain low. It asks whether exceptions are reaching the right humans. It asks whether bad outcomes are recoverable without chaos. It also asks whether the organization is learning from intervention, meaning whether recurring exceptions lead to boundary improvements rather than repeated supervision cost. Measurement becomes decisive here. If human oversight is shifting toward exception-based control, organizations need indicators that show it. Escalation volume shows how much work is being pushed upward. Resolution quality shows whether human intervention materially improves outcomes. Policy violation rates show whether boundaries are being respected. Time to resolve exceptions shows whether the human layer is becoming a new bottleneck. Rework rates show whether decision classifications are sensible the first time. Over a longer horizon, a telling measure is whether repeated exception classes shrink as feedback loops mature. If the same avoidable cases keep appearing, the architecture is not learning. Those measures still require care. High escalation volume does not automatically mean the system is unsafe, because thresholds might be too tight, or the policy might be too vague. Low escalation volume does not automatically mean maturity, because the system might be bypassing cases that should pause. Fast resolution does not automatically mean healthy supervision, because humans might be clearing queues without meaningful judgment. The goal is not a single flattering number. The goal is evidence that human attention is being reserved for interventions that actually matter. For that reason, decision traces and review have to be operational routines rather than emergency rituals. Decision traces should be produced consistently as normal practice. Audit readiness should be maintained continuously, rather than assembled after an incident. Governance reviews should examine exception patterns, boundary performance, permission scopes, and recovery outcomes on a regular basis. At the same time, reviews must not become a disguised return to blanket approval. Their job is to tune the architecture, not to reinsert humans into every routine case. A strong governance review asks questions like these. Are the same exception classes repeating because the policy boundary is unclear? Are recoverable classes staying recoverable, or are they clustering into a larger risk pattern? Are certain human owners receiving too many escalations because routing logic is poor? Are thresholds generating long queues without meaningful improvements in quality? Are policy conflicts being resolved in ways that can be codified, or are they staying dependent on ad hoc interpretation? When reviews work at that level, they improve the system without turning into another bottleneck. This brings the discussion back to transformation fatigue, often described too vaguely. In many organizations, fatigue is not mainly a reaction to new technology, it is a reaction to authority flow that no longer makes sense. Teams are told to trust agentic systems, but also to approve everything. Managers are told to own outcomes, but not given decision rights that match that ownership. Workers are asked to adapt, while the workflow adds more interrupts, more alerts, and more ambiguity. Fatigue follows because the organization tries to run two constitutions at once. It wants the speed of agentic autonomy and the comfort of legacy sign-off culture. People then do extra work without gaining clearer authority. The best frame for change management is redesigning agency itself. Pace matters, because people need time to learn the new architecture. Still, pace alone is not enough. The organization must explain why roles are changing, what authority is moving, and which decisions people now own. It must also make visible which approvals are no longer required. Relief from obsolete approvals is not a side benefit. It is a core precondition for exception-based governance. Managers need that relief in particular. If they are still buried in routine approvals, they cannot do the higher value work the new architecture requires. They cannot coach judgment. They cannot interpret policy at the boundary. They cannot reconcile cross-functional conflicts. They cannot use decision traces to detect pattern failures. They cannot improve escalation logic. Human on the exception succeeds only when meaningless approval load is actually removed, not merely renamed. Role clarity has to be explicit. A manager needs to know which decisions still require direct human ownership, which have moved into bounded agent execution, and which arrive only as exceptions. A creative or context-heavy team needs to know where its judgment is still decisive and where it is no longer being asked to police routine machine output. An executive needs to know which risk decisions remain at the senior level and which have been translated into policy and threshold logic below. Without that visibility, the new system feels arbitrary. With it, people can see the new shape of responsibility. Incentives have to reinforce that shape. If the organization rewards only raw speed, people will hide exceptions or widen permissions too aggressively. If it rewards only queue clearance, managers will keep processing queues even when the better outcome is to eliminate unnecessary exceptions upstream. If it rewards only visible error avoidance, teams may over-escalate and flood the human layer. Better incentives reward measurable efficiency gains that occur without rising policy violation rates. They also reward learning at small scale. A team that documents a recurring exception class clarifies the boundary and reduces future interruptions creates governance value, even if that work looks less dramatic than shipping a new feature. Performance metrics should reflect the same logic. Managers should not be evaluated mainly on approval throughput, because that metric belongs to the older architecture. In the newer model, a better manager may clear fewer queues because fewer weak cases reach the queue in the first place. Better performance can mean lower unnecessary escalation, higher resolution quality on exceptions that do escalate, cleaner policy enforcement, faster recovery from real exceptions, and visible boundary improvements over time. A queue that disappears because the system improved is more valuable than a queue that gets processed quickly and reappears tomorrow. A practical leadership test follows. Are governance policies explicit enough to guide real cases? Is escalation design specific enough that the right human receives the right kind of exception? Are audit and logging part of normal operations rather than emergency repair? Do feedback loops actually change thresholds, policies, and permission scopes? Do incentives reward sound delegation and learning rather than approval theatre? Does each role understand what it owns and what it no longer needs to approve? Is the transition paced in stages rather than announced as a leap? Are reliability gates strong enough to block premature expansion? If the answers remain vague, autonomy is likely outrunning governance. When these elements align, human on the exception does not remove humans from accountability. It makes accountability more honest. Humans remain accountable for the boundaries they define, the permissions they grant, the exceptions they resolve, and the trade-offs they legitimate. What changes is where attention goes. Instead of spending human effort on every ordinary step, the organization concentrates that effort. Where judgment, conflict resolution, and legitimacy are actually required. Several uncertainties remain, and they are important. Threshold tuning will likely vary across domains, because the meaning of risk, reversibility, and stakeholder sensitivity is not uniform. Organizations are also still learning how quickly they can adapt from feedback without corrupting memory, overfitting to recent exceptions, or destabilizing the governance state made of rules, thresholds, permissions, and traces. There is also an ongoing challenge in handling irreconcilable conflicts. Surfacing too many can overload the human layer, while surfacing too few can push the system toward improvised authority. These uncertainties should not be treated as a reason to keep the old model unchanged. They are a reason to treat the transition as governed learning. Thresholds will need tuning. Exception definitions will need revision. Permissions will prove too broad in some areas and too narrow in others. Some review paths show genuine value, and others turn out to be leftovers from approval culture rather than necessary protections. The organization that learns well is not the one that eliminates friction everywhere. It is the one that can tell useful friction apart from wasteful friction. The practical outcome is straightforward. An oversight pattern can be described as a control architecture rather than a vague promise. The organization can ask where work proceeds automatically, where it pauses, where it escalates, and where it stops. It can ask who owns each decision class, what permissions are active, and how failures are recovered. Once those questions are asked clearly, the current design stops looking natural or inevitable. It becomes something that can be examined and redesigned, and that redesign can be drafted in staged form. Some decisions remain with humans because they involve values, stakeholder meaning, or unresolved trade-offs. Some move to agents because they are routine, bounded, and recoverable under stable policy. Some are defined as exceptions in advance because they require human intervention only under particular conditions. This is the move from constant gates to selective governance. It is the move from asking whether a human touched every case to asking whether human attention is placed where it does the most real work. In that sense, the destination is not less oversight. It is oversight that is more selective, more operational, and more truthful about where authority actually lives. Sources in NIST's AI Risk Management Framework, released in 2024, was the main governance anchor for the lecture. It supplied the language for the trustworthy AI, oversight, auditability, and the need to treat agentic systems as a distinct controls problem. The European Union's Artificial Intelligence Act shaped the sections on human oversight in high-risk systems. It provided the legal frame for effective human oversight and the requirement that qualified people can interpret, stop, or override system outputs. Anthropic's Model Context Protocol, along with related engineering documentation from LangGraph, Galileo, and AxonFlow, grounded the technical discussion of agent orchestration, tool access, approval gates, and runtime policy enforcement. These sources helped translate autonomous agents into concrete workflow design. The World Economic Forum's Future of Jobs reporting, together with McKinsey's recent AI Trust and Governance Survey, do not quote, informed the middle management and transformation fatigue sections. They supported the point that adoption depends on redesigning roles, incentives, and authority, not just adding new tools. Organizational design and applied psychology research on decision rights, responsibility matrices, decision fatigue, psychological safety, blame dynamics, and trust in human-agent teams supported the human side of the story. That cluster helped explain why unclear authority slows execution and why clear escalation paths reduce overload. Security and engineering material on decision traces, identity, access control, memory, and multi-agent failure recovery backed the accountability and resilience sections. It provided the practical case for provenance, rollback, bounded autonomy, and clear audit trails. This concludes the audiobook narration. Thank you for listening.